Reform Judaism, my dear friends, began as a vote of confidence in the Father Faith. The original and motive purpose of Reform was to clear away the rust and the barnacles from the ship of faith, which had just passed through a long and difficult voyage in troubled waters, so that the ship could move on, unencumbered, free. The founding assumption of Reformed Judaism was that Judaism was seaworthy. Anyone who did not believe so disembarked and found other means of transportation. Now, the early reformers liked to compare Judaism to a tree. They said Judaism, too, had its roots, its trunk, its boughs, and its leaves. And at each turn of the cultural season, at each autumn, when the moods, the intellectual moods of the world change, the leaves dropped off. Customs, folkways, mystical symbols, messianic ideas. But the trunk, the skeleton of the tree, weathered the winds of change. And it bore within it the seed, the possibility of a new foliage the next spring. A splendid foliage of meaningful worship and binding song, serious thought and high challenge. Reform then is a movement of rejuvenation. It is designed to renew the ancient and the venerable faith. Reform Judaism was never thought of as a self-contained and self-sufficient group of Jews who bowed to any other god but the God of Sinai, and who accepted any other moral commandment than the mitzvot of our Bible. I say this because there has grown up in our midst a group of Reformed Jews who I'm afraid have turned in on themselves. They emphasize the Reform and not the Jew, the change, and not the changeless. And strangely, and perhaps paradoxically, I find them most among those very verbal and aggressive universalists who are always complaining that Jews give too much to the United Jewish Appeal and not enough to the United Appeal, too much to their own causes and not enough to all other causes. And yet these are precisely the Jews who are most aloof and distant when it comes to the matter of group religious identification. Reform is simply a movement of Jewish renewal. It is the Judaism which we emphasize, yet it is a reform which is enticing to many. For reform has all the connotations which are exciting to our age: newness, change, contemporaneity, experimentation. And Judaism speaks of a venerable tradition, a tradition whose wisdom must be searched out and unlocked. And this is the hatchet age. We like to cut away the old, to free ourselves of the binding. We have no patience with research and with search, with finding out, with describing again the wisdom of the ages. And some of us in our arrogance believe that only this age has wisdom. And so there are some schools and there are some pulpits which emphasize the new and not the venerable, which teach their young people that somehow traditional Judaism is an archaism, a relic, a medieval, an outdated mode. We are the enlightened, they are the benighted. And in doing so, of course, we set up between ourselves unnecessary barriers within the household of Judaism. And in doing so, we cut ourselves off from a useful and necessary historical conservatism, which is the counterweight and the balance to our tendency to be rash and impulsive. Reform is a vote of confidence in Judaism. But I'm afraid that there are some professional liberals among us who look upon reform as a faith of infinite plasticity and elasticity. I often think they believe that Reform Judaism is like a spiritual jellyfish, quivering all over, opaque and translucent, able to refract every color and shade of the cultural world, forming and refashioning itself to every shift in the current of the cultural sea. What is old and embarrassing, they're willing to cut away. What is new, whether it's simply stylish and voguish, or whether it's substantial, they want to bring in into themselves. And when anyone says to them, "This is Judaism, on this we cannot bend," they become very put out. After all, we ought to be open and infinitely receptive. I want to put these remarks in the connotation of the first commandment. I am the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. The first commandment is simply the statement, the naming, the affirmation of God. But there are those who wonder why we must continue to affirm God. After all, they look about themselves, they look at themselves, and they realize that this is an age of weakening faith. And their children ask them embarrassing questions. "Explain to me, show me this invisible God you talk about." And they ask even more embarrassing questions. "How is it that you belong to a God-affirming congregation, and prayer and piety play such marginal and tangential roles in your lives?" Why not, these professional liberals among us say, why not just put aside all this embarrassment? Let's put God in the deep freeze. Let's put theology in mothballs. Let's allow reform to emerge as a pristine and clear humanistic morality. That we can argue and that we can convince people of. Why must we continue to speak of God, to search for God, to try and find some principle of harmony in all the cacophony and the confusion of our age? Now, the thought is tempting. It's tempting to anyone who has had a long, involved discussion with his child, seeking to make clear that which can never be quite clear, seeking to make another aware of the spirit which infuses the universe, which one can sense and but not fully know. It's tempting. It's always tempting to court popularity. But imagine what would happen if a Jew joined those who say that God is dead. If a Jew went to God's funeral, what would he do there? He'd stand beside the coffin and he'd say, "Yisgadal, Yisgadash, Shmei Rabbah. Exalted and sanctified be God's great name." Even when we bury God, we can't avoid praising him and glorifying him. And the very absurdity of this image points to the absurdity of a godless Judaism. Judaism begins in the affirmation of God's presence in and within the universe. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And Judaism grounds morality, ethics, virtue in God's will and in his being. Kadoshim to you. Ki kadosh ani Adonai Eloheichem. Holy shalt thou be, for I, the Lord thy God, am holy. And Judaism graces our lives with what comfort it can. It brightens the tragedy of our being with the hope of God's comfort and presence. Gam ki elech begeitz al mavet lo yira ra ki ata imadi. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. Judaism, without this God concept, without the reality of God's being, is an archaism, an historical curiosity. Now, I say this quite deliberately because I know that there are those who would like to see Judaism only in terms of a teaching of goodness, political liberalism. I say this in the full knowledge that there is a rabbi in Detroit who has affirmed that God is not. Some look on this man as a pioneer, a trailbreaker. They believe he is heroic. I look on him, I confess, rather as a woe-begone straggler, trying to catch up with a baggage train of the legion of the non-believers. God knows that agnosticism and disbelief have academic credentials in our day. What he is saying has been said for 300 years and more. It is not new. He is not a pioneer. And one must fault him for a vulgar form of spiritual hucksterism. Why must he seek to have a congregation which will listen to his theological idiosyncrasies based upon the vestigial ethnic loyalties of Jews? Why not simply go out and pioneer, build a congregation which will search with him for wherever that search may lead them? When Felix Adler set out to find the ethical culture movement, he had the good sense to leave Temple Emmanuel and to go across Central Park and to found a new movement. But this man insists on finding it within Judaism, which means in taking a God-affirming faith, denuding it of God, and claiming it to be the old faith. Now, it may be that we have reached that stage in the Enlightenment where the God idea is discredited, where it can no longer be believed. Then Judaism is no more than historical curiosity. Let's put it aside. Let's give it a decent burial. And if we do, let's at least allow this venerable faith of ours that decency. Let's not turn it in its last minutes and moments into a parody and caricature of its ancient self. It is the root that holds the tree to the ground. It is the root through which the tree draws nourishment. If this root idea in Judaism, the root idea of God in which all of Judaism flourishes, is cut away, then I am afraid that Judaism will die of spiritual malnutrition. Look about you for the children and the grandchildren of those who converted Judaism on their own into an ethical culture. And if we cut away this root, I'm afraid that the tree can no longer stand firm. We cannot support our teachings. Look about you for the children and the grandchildren of those to whom Judaism was perhaps a gastronomic delight, but certainly nothing more or less than an ethnic liability. Where is their activity among us? Where is their presence among us? Judaism does not have the option of turning itself into a non-God-believing faith. Reformed Judaism does not have the option of voting no confidence in Judaism. But we have only to look about us to see Jews, our neighbors, who have no express faith in God. Sometimes we have to look no further than the mirror of our souls. Faith in God is hard to come by, is it not, in our century? You know, much of what these so-called death of God theologians have been saying about you, which you've been hearing so much, is not a substantive argument to whether God is or is not, but a psychological description of our times. And they're saying simply this: when the modern tries to tune the universe in, he tries to become sensitive, to sensitize himself to some spiritual being, he finds static in his earphones. When he tries to see beyond his own small world, he's confronted by a dark, impenetrable cloud of confusion and non-understanding. It is not that God is dead or is not dead. It is simply, they say, that the modern cannot grope his way to God. And each of us in our own lives can testify to the difficulty and to the confusion, the difficulty we have in this search. Faith is no longer the all-embracing cultural milieu, the ethos in which we live. Unfaith, non-faith, disbelief is. It's hard to work out the harmony from all the separate facts which crowd in about us. Faith is hard to come by in our century, but it can be had. There are men of faith. One of those who is most prominent in this new school of the death of God theologians is a man named Thomas Altizer. He's a professor in one of the Virginia universities. Thomas Altizer, I'm afraid, is guilty of the same kind of spiritual arrogance with which he faults the ecclesiastics of another age. Those churchmen who said, you know, that because we Jews would not affirm Christ, we were somehow biologically stunted, genetically blind in the matters of the spirit. For he makes an obiter dictu of this kind. The man who chooses to live in our history can neither know the reality of God's presence nor understand the world as his creation. Now, you and I live in our history. We're not afraid of the 20th century. We accept it. We hope of the greatest of it. We are not afraid of knowledge. We are eager for it. We are cultured people and educated people, and many of us by our learning qualify by that terrible name of intellectuals. And yet we can we not, see God's hand somehow within the mystery of creation? And we do we not affirm the being of God? No, we will not be written out of our century so easily. The believer, I am afraid, bears the seed of doubt within him. He is not as confident as the non-believer, and so he's always willing to be humble before the man who says, "You don't know enough, little man. You don't know enough to not believe. You're afraid of this century. You're bourgeois. You're a boob. Turn away. Look, if you really looked and saw the way I see this world, then you would come to doubt." Not so fast. Not so fast. Faith in 1966 has as firm an intellectual credential as non-faith. Agnosticism, atheism, humanism, secularism, call it what you will, are not the only alternatives which, as reasonable men, we have. First, let me ask this question. Why is it that so many of us have such difficulty affirming? Why so? The answers vary, and there are many, but one answer stands out supremely, and it's this. 20th century man is in love with himself. Somehow in the last 100 years, we have become aware of our individuality. We no longer feel ourselves tied to the soil or tied down by the economic iron laws. Man has broken the bonds. And at times we stand reverently before the skills of hand and mind which have given us our knowledge. And at times we stand in fear and trembling before the vast passions which we have learnt lurk within us. In fear or in trembling, in reverence or in awe, we are auto-intoxicated. We live in and for this world, this life, our life only. We lack the ability to see beyond. We look up into the heavens, and what do we see? Not the tracery of God's hand, but the vapor trail of a missile or a jet. We look into the mystery of life, and what do we see? Not the miracle of life itself, but all of the minute chemical components and viruses of which it is a part, the things which we have uncovered. Man is hypnotized by his own being. I reread recently Sartre's play, The Flies, and in it the chief protagonist makes this speech. "I alone," he says, "I am alone. I demanded a sign. I sent messages to heaven. No reply. Heaven ignored my very name. Each minute I wondered what I could be in the eyes of God. Now I know the answer, nothing. God does not see me. God does not hear me. God does not know me. You see this emptiness over our heads? That's God. You see this gap in the door? It is God. You see that hole in the ground? That is God again. Silence is God, absence is God. God is the loneliness of man. God is the loneliness of man. There was no one but myself. I alone decided on evil. I alone invented God. It was I who cheated. It was I who worked miracles. It was I who accused myself today. I alone can absolve myself. I, man. If God exists, man is nothing. If man exists, God doesn't exist. I. And I submit that is the mood of our day. In the worship of this little congregation in Detroit, which affirms that they disbelieve, they've taken the text of the Micha Mocha, which we sang today. Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the mighty? Who is like unto thee, glorious in holiness? And it reads this way. Who is like unto man, glorious in holiness? Who is like unto man, glorious in holiness? And this, mind you, in the age of Auschwitz and Hiroshima and Napalm and Vietnam. Who is like unto man, glorious in holiness? When you put your hand before your eye, you cannot see the glory of the heavens. When you look for your own image in the glass becomes a mirror. Man intoxicated by himself can see only man. But this is a mood, not a fact. And when these theologians claim that the death of God is an historical fact, I answer them simply, the death of God is a psychological fact. You have lost the ability to sense God. I still have the ability to sense God. There are some for whom the modern learning has made them indifferent to the whole religious enterprise. And there are others for whom the modern learning has made them eager for the whole religious enterprise. It's a matter of mood. And someday, our inventions, our self-awareness is going to become commonplace. And the bulk of men are going to be able to look out and to look beyond and to look within and to see something other than themselves. Now, moods are not facts. And if the mood of our age is one of weakening belief, and it is certainly an age in which belief is hard to come by, I submit to you that the reasons lie not in new facts, not in our science, not in our learning, not in any iron law of logic which points out that there can be no God, but simply in the temper of the times, in the mood of the moment. And moods change. There are cycles, long sweeping cycles in the flow of history. There can yet be and will yet be a time when the many will turn and come again. What does faith require in 1966? Torah, learning, search, wisdom. If there is any damning criticism which must be made of religion in our age, it is an idle time profession for idle minds. You put your mind aside when you come to temple. Your mind is for your business. Your mind is for your profession. Here's a place for quiet, where you're not interrupted in a silent reverie. But the idle mind, the rusty mind, the sleepy mind, the lazy mind, which has only the platitudes, the shop-worn platitudes of another century to work with, cannot confront the very real problems of our day, cannot confront the challenges of the new knowledge of our day. Hammarskjöld said this once, how many have been driven into the outer darkness by too easy talk of faith. Why is it that our children very often turn against us when we give them insufficient answers to the questions of God and belief? Because the answers are insufficient. Because they're childish answers. Because religion is not one of those areas in which we are willing to bestir our mental processes. If we do, all can become clear. If we are willing to think, we will find that instead of being the conservative element, we are the radicals. Instead of being the benighted, we are the enlightened. And that the arguments of disbelief are cluttered with common sense truisms which are no longer sent in the common sense and which lack a basis in fact. The Cosmonauts, as you remember, when they first went up, looked out into the heavens through their porthole, and they couldn't see God. Mr. Khrushchev laughed long and loud. You see, God isn't there. Now, what's behind all this? A vague medieval notion of piety, a superstition that God was on a throne in heaven? Yes. But where do you find it in Judaism? The whole world, our Bible says, is grounded in his being. Where do you find in our Bible that God is up there, that God is out there? Thou canst not see my face, yet I will make all thy my glory pass before thee. God is of nature, but he is not natural. He infuses nature, but he cannot be seen in nature. This much we all see. But why is it that so many of us pale before the naivete that because God cannot be found by some intricate research instrument, therefore there is no God? That because God cannot be shown by scientific method, therefore, there is no God. Because we have not examined the very nature of truth. There are many kinds of truth and many legitimate logics. And empirical reason and scientific investigation are only one of these. There's a logic of poetry. There's a logic of feeling. There's a logic of love. There's a logic of art. There's a logic of myth-making. There's a logic of religion. And each of these logics, each of these ways by which the mind becomes aware of the world in which we live, has brought us a great deal of learning and of wisdom, of understanding how much poorer our world would have been without them. Science can answer certain ranges of questions, surprisingly narrow areas. How? A description. A new control over natural force. Science cannot give us values. Science cannot give us a sense of the purpose of life. Science cannot guide us into our own dignity. Science cannot offer us thou shalt and thou shalt not, the morality, the values, the ethic, which we all require. We have to turn to other areas of the mind, other responses of the being, and among these and central to these, of course, is that of faith. Being lazy, most of us, in matters religious, having thought about it till we were, 13? Hardly thought about it since. Believing that religion is an idle occupation for a sunny Sunday morning, most of us, I'm afraid, have given over the intellectual field to the non-believers. And we've allowed this image to grow among us that we are the non-thinkers and that they are the intellectuals. That they have the arguments and all we have is sort of a stubborn faith. What a travesty that is of our ancient faith. This Judaism of ours never glorified ignorance. This Judaism of ours never accepted the paradox as proof of the truth. Torah Ora, the rabbi said again and again. Torah Ora, the light is learning, the light is truth, truth is light, and by truth shalt thou live. We never turned away from the world. We were never afraid of learning. But learning must be mastered. Learning must be digested. You must understand it for it to have meaning. And that is what our philosophers, our Hillels and our Philos, our Halevis and our Maimonides, and the rabbis of this day have tried to do, to confront the world, to understand what is merely voguish, fad of the moment, what is true and what has deep meaning. We have nothing to fear in learning except our unwillingness to learn. And it is of that unwillingness that I'm afraid religion today stands convicted. We've allowed the non-religionists to build straw men again and again and to knock them down. We haven't even realized they were building straw men. Ever and again, one who's been analyzed says to me, I now realize I was sick. And when I was sick, I projected upon the universe my anxieties, my neuroses, my needs for dependency. Now I'm stronger. And I realize that I projected this I projected my needs upon the world. Therefore, there is no God. It's a straw man.
We project feelings on every friend and every member of our family, but it doesn't prove that they are not real. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Jeremiah thundered against the Judeans of his day, who had projected their needs for a protective God upon the heavens, who assumed that God would guarantee the borders of Israel, God would guarantee the walls of the temple. He said, "Thy God is no God. There is no protection in this." Yet Jeremiah affirmed God. What we must be willing to do is to go beyond the commonplace truisms which clutter up our thought. To be willing to confront this universe of ours in all of its diversity, in all of its magnificence, and in all of its wisdom. The man of faith has little to fear in learning except his own unwillingness to absorb it, to digest it, to make it his own. And this is the challenge which confronts the Jew, the Reformed Jew today. If reform is a vote of confidence in Judaism as it is, if reform is a program for the renewal of Judaism as it was conceived to be and as it must be, and if we desire to be among the forerunners, the trailblazers, the pioneers, then it is we who must confront this wonderful, confusing, amazing world of ours, bring harmony into it, and find within it the living presence of God. There's no more to change. There's no more to break down. There's little need still to cut away. That part of our job has been done. Now it is our task to give depth, foundation, dimension, reason, philosophy, and logic to our faith. And this cannot be done by a rabbi alone. It must be done in every home, by every Jew, finding his own spiritual footing, transmitting that to his children, giving them a sense of the meaningfulness of belief, meaningfulness of God. Let me end with one last thought. Why do we need to bother with all of this search? Why do we need to try and assimilate the various philosophies and the various knowledges of our day and to bring them into one unity and one whole? If religion is only a matter of peace of mind, of comfort, many say, why bother? Here's a drug. Here's a guaranteed annuity. They'll bring you peace of mind more quickly and more surely than will your faith. And to a certain degree, that's true. But what is faith? Faith is search. It's a search for the meaning of life. It's a search for direction. It's a search for the ultimate values against which we can judge all of our daily responsibilities. The paradigm of the Jew is Abraham. Abraham, who was commanded by God, Lech lecha me'artzecha u'me'moladetecha u'me'beit avicha el ha'aretz asher ereka. Get thee out. Get thee out of thy common habitat. Get thee out of the world which is familiar to you. Break away from the prejudices of the people around you. Break out into the 20th century. Come into your own. Where will you go? There's no specific direction. Break out and you'll find yourself. And finding yourself, you'll find God. And having found God, what have you found? You have found the ugliness of your own idols, the ugliness of race, and the ugliness of chauvinism, the ugliness of class, the ugliness of ambition, the ugliness of status seeking, the ugliness of power, all the vain idols which we are prone, each of us, to worship. Why must we find God? Because God is the unity of the universe, the unity which gives direction, wholeness, wholesomeness to our lives. Can we find God? We can. We must. Amen.